How do you know he's 7K?
I got a nose for white supremacy, and he smells like bleach.
Hello, and welcome to the Cephala Podcast, where we are discussing the HBO show Watchmen. I am your host, Scott.
And I'm Jason.
And we're going to be going episode by episode through the 2019 Watchmen show. I'm a huge Watchmen fan from way back in the day. I've read the comic, I think, a bajillion times. Jason, on the other hand, much more of a Watchmen novice. So we are going to be approaching the show from two different points of view. I think it'll be interesting. So we're kicking off. This is season one, episode one. And it's called It's Summer and We're Running Out of Ice. So the episode opens where we see an old-timey black and white silent film, and we see a hooded figure on horseback chasing another horse.
Oh, wait, can we curse?
Sure. This is a Watchmen podcast. This is not a family podcast. You can drop the F-bomb if you want.
Okay, because this show is fucking crazy. All right.
Indeed. Oh, I suppose that's another thing worth noting. I want to say this is my third or fourth time through the show. This is one of my all-time favorite shows. Again, Jason has not seen it, so it'll be interesting what he picks up versus what I pick up. But so our attention to detail, I think, will be different. Do you have any other questions, or do you just want to know if you can swear?
No, that was – I mean, I had some comments on the episode as a whole, but I guess that can wait until the end.
So. Okay.
Yeah. Proceed.
So we see two figures on horseback chasing each other. One of them lassos the other. You see the hood come off of the lassoer, and you see that it's a black guy. There's, I want to say voiceover, but that's not the right word. The text on the screen, because it's a silent film, makes mention that it's Bass Reeves, the black marshal of Oklahoma. Bass Reeves was actually a real marshal from Oklahoma, and he arrested over 3,000 criminals. So he's a real guy that has a pretty rich history. And then the camera sort of pulls back, and we see a little boy is watching this film. You see him watching it in a theater. And then we see a woman, and she's very distraught, and she's playing the piano. And then all of a sudden, an air raid siren goes off. The building shakes, and a man runs in from the outside who's presumably the boy's dad, and he says, it's time to go. So what we see is that there's a little boy basically in the movie theater. I mean, he's probably, I don't know, how old do you think that kid was, Jason? 4?
Yeah, something like that.
He's pretty young. And so mom and dad basically run outside, and they grab the kid. And it cuts to the exterior of this town, and we see that there's a big, there's text on the screen that says Tulsa 1921. So we know that this is almost 100 years ago. And we see airplanes shooting black citizens in the streets. It's a predominantly black town. We see men in Klan robes with fire, and they're kind of like, taunting the citizens, trying to get them, corral them, I suppose. They're starting fires.
Now, this is an actual historical event.
It is, indeed. Did you know anything about this before?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was like, what, this really looks like the Tulsa Massacre, because it's like a black town, and then they show that it's Tulsa, and I'm like, oh, damn. This is like some wild stuff to start out a series with. Like, this scene is, it's such a crazy story that really happened, the Tulsa Massacre. I feel like it needs to be talked about more, because it's such a indicative moment in American history, I think. But to start out a show with, like, inside this happening is pretty crazy, kind of emotionally and manipulative a little bit, but definitely powerful. So I thought it was
Definitely jarring. Starts off with a bang, for sure. Like, it is, I mean, it's just immediately action. So, yeah that's... I was not aware of this. History is not my forte. I was not aware of the Tulsa Massacre. I was not aware. Well, we'll get into some of the other history later. I do remember talking to my brother when this came out, and he was like, did you know that was a thing? And I went, no, I must not have paid attention during that history class. So, It is indeed based on the Tulsa Massacre, and there will be more information on that. Actually, there's a whole, you know, subplot of the history of Oklahoma back in the 20s.
Oh, cool.
Ultimately, we do see the mom and the dad and the little kid, and they run into a barn, and they are attempting basically to get out of town on this car. The driver says, you know, there's no more room, so dad says, okay, we'll just take the boy. And he basically throws the boy in, like, this little steamer trunk. But before he does, he gives him a piece of paper. I think it was like one of the flyers from the movie theater or something. And he writes, watch out for this boy. Actually, you don't see that yet. You see him write something on the paper, and he puts it in the boy's pocket. And then
does he say watch out or take care of this boy?
I wrote down watch out. Did I really write down the wrong thing?
No.
The point is, he leaves. Well, now I got to look at it.
That makes sense because it's the Watchmen, and there's lots of references to watching things.
Oh, that's
true. Would make more sense. But I wonder if that sounds kind of strange and ominous, like watch out for this boy. I just thought it was.
Oh, I didn't
like,
think about that. Yeah.
Just take care of him or something. You know, so whoever finds the note would just like hopefully take care of him, maybe. But
well, that's clearly their intention, is that, you know, they want somebody to essentially adopt their kid, because they don't know if they're going to make it out of this town alive. So, he puts that in the kid's pocket and, you know, basically tells
this. Okay, we're kind of both right. It says watch over this boy is what it says.
So I was just getting to that. Okay. That does make more sense. But, you know, I didn't even, I mean, I guess the word watch is in it, and it's the watchman. So, okay. So ultimately the kid makes it out on this car, but it gets, you know, blown up, I suppose. And there was an adult man and an adult woman, and they get killed. And the kid wakes up, the little boy wakes up in a field later after this explosion, presumably it knocked him out. And it's now dark, so it's been several hours later. And he pulls the paper out of his pocket, and that's when we see the words on the paper and that says, watch over this boy. And he looks around the field. The driver's dead. The mom is dead, or the woman is dead. But he finds a baby alive in the field, like a newborn or, you know, maybe 3 months old. He picks it up. He wraps it in an American flag, and then he sort of starts walking down this road with the town on fire behind him. And that's the three scenes, I guess, that take place in the past. And like you said, it starts out with a bang. There's a pretty serious set of scenes that are just action packed. And then it cuts, and we're in the present day. So we are in, at this point, it was 2019 when the show came out. So we were in 1921, and now we fast forward to 2019. So that's 98 years later. We see a truck driving down the road, and it has a battery meter. So this is, it's an electric truck. So I don't know if you remember from the last episode or the previous, where we talked about the Dr. Manhattan has sort of changed how the world works. There's much more plentiful electricity. So the world has electric cars. But this truck gets pulled over by the cops, and the tension in this scene is really crazy. He gets pulled over by the cops. The cop shines the light right in the driver's eyes. You can't see the cop at all. The cop asks him for license and registration, and when he opens the glove compartment, we see him move a Rorschach mask out of the way. So from the 1985 comic, Rorschach was one of the main characters. He died at the end of the comic. So there is no more Rorschach. So this is not the Rorschach. And that immediately sets the police officer on edge, because the Rorschach mask is well known in this universe as being a symbol of a hate organization, which will come up later. Ultimately, the organization is spun out of the Rorschach of the original comic and his manifesto. So the cop, now that he's alarmed, because of seeing the Rorschach mask, goes back to his car, and he has to request authorization essentially from, you know, the mothership back at police headquarters to use his weapon. His weapon is on lockdown. So cops in this universe are not allowed to carry weapons without approval. But there's some negotiation back and forth through the radio of him attempting to get his gun unlocked, and it really builds the tension. And right after he gets his gun unlocked and he can go confront this guy that he's pulled over, the windshield of his car just gets blown open, and the guy in the truck shoots this cop multiple times, and then kind of looks in, and he was indeed carrying lettuce in the back of his truck, so he throws a head of lettuce through the hole in the windshield and onto this dying cop. So what we see in this scene is we're alerted that the police and the authorities in this universe are very different than ours. Number one, they don't have any guns. They're not allowed to use guns without authorization. And the cop is wearing a yellow face mask. I mean, it almost looks like a COVID mask, but this came out before COVID. So in this universe, all the cops have essentially secret identities, like a superhero, where they cover their face. And that is to prevent criminals from learning their real identity. And that will come up later. So the cops definitely have a privacy thing going on. You with me so far, Jason?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is also kind of like a very striking scene. It's evocative of, I think, what was happening at the time, or like or shortly after the like BLM riots and stuff. And I mean, that was a really hot topic around this time, like 2019, I think. So it's sort of shifted in a sense that, you know, the cop is the one that's sort of looked at as the good guy here, and the mask is supposed to help protect them. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they're trying to say something about police violence or police brutality by shifting the roles and who's what, you know, but it kind of bugged me a little bit, I guess, this setup, and I'm not sure if they're trying to say something about that or if it just sort of is an unfortunate thing that they've chosen to go with in this world. But
well, I have an answer to that, but it's very much tied to the next scene in the police. So let's hold off a little bit. Yes. That is a theme. That is pretty much the theme of the entire show. But we'll circle back to that in a second. Mm. We cut to a play. We cut to the famous musical Oklahoma, and it's an all-black performance of Oklahoma, which I don't know if you've ever seen Oklahoma, but it is very much a white kind of play. So the fact that this is an all-black performance is unique. In the middle of the play, we see a cop in a yellow face mask, like the one that was previously shot, come in the middle of this play and pull, essentially the police chief out of this play to let him know that a cop has been shot. So they go to the hospital, and immediately the police chief, his name is Judd, kind of goes into, crisis mode. And he asks, you know, make sure that anyone that has seen this cop's face, check their backgrounds. And they're very secretive about, you know, this officer that's been shot, because now his face has been revealed. And they want to make sure that his privacy is assured. Judd was, since he was at a play, he is changing into his police uniform in the hospital. And at one point you can see that he has three bullet wounds in his shoulder, so three scars. Oh, it's worth mentioning. So Judd meets one of the, costumed heroes in this show, and his name is Looking Glass, and he wears a mask that's similar to a Rorschach mask, but it's very, like, you know, form-fitting to your face, and it's made out of reflective material. And the chief says, pull your face down, and he uses the reflection in his mask to tie his tie. But I wrote that down because he doesn't say pull your mask down. Rorschach, what he did in the original is he called the mask that he wore his face. And at one point his mask gets taken away and he freaks out because his, you know, I guess human face isn't his real face. The mask is his face. So it's interesting that the chief calls this mask a face because of the way Rorschach referred to his. Rorschach was crazy. So I'm not sure what exactly that says about
Wasn't he like kind of like a loser? Like his real identity?
Oh yeah,
was kind of like a loser dude that I don't know. Just, you know, he wasn't like a Bruce Wayne character underneath the mask. So his mask was probably,
yeah, his alter ego. He was, I mean, if it was modern, I mean, he would probably be an incel, or he would be socially outcast. Nobody talked to him. He wasn't really in, he didn't want to talk to anybody. He had major, I don't know. He just kind of hated everybody. He had definite racial issues. He, you know, was most likely anti-Semitic. He was just kind of generally a bad dude. I mean, he was not somebody you'd want to hang out with. We see the cops caravan. Sutton was the name of the police officer, to his house to tell his wife that he's been shot. The chief mentions that they're going to do surgery in the hospital and then move him to the secure police medical facility so they don't even leave these cops in the hospital because it's such a security risk. Judd asks his wife, did he tell anyone he was police? And his wife responds, no, of course not. That's against the rules. And Judd says, yeah, I mean, we know that's the rule, but sometimes people tell anyway. And she says, no, he told people he was going to night school for engineering. So even the cops, you know, have to have secret identities. They have to tell people they're doing something else. They can't just go to work as a cop because this is a different universe and cops aren't treated or respected like they are in 2023 when we're recording this. And this is sort of the next scene cuts to inside of a schoolroom, and we see a lady named Angela Abar, and she's going to be the main character of this show. And it's career day at her at the school, and she is telling the kids how to make some eggs. And she makes mention that egg whites are made out of protein. And she cracks some eggs in the bowl. And there's a ton of symbolism here. So she makes mention that you have to separate the egg, the colored part of the egg, from the white part of the egg. So there's sort of some racial hints here that things need to be separated.
Yeah, that's totally what I got. She says to make a foam with the eggs that cause bubbles, then the protein helps you with the walls. So if we don't have walls, it all comes tumbling down. We got to separate them. I mean, so this this is a little weird for me to have this sort of theme that's popping up here, that like, okay, we got to separate people.
Oh, she's just talking about separating eggs, but yeah.
Okay. And they zoom in on the eggs, and that's like the first quote that they show. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I'm curious to see where this goes. But
did you notice anything else about the eggs?
It forms a smiley face.
It does make a smiley face. Do you know why that's significant?
Because it was on the cover of the comic?
The button that the comedian wears that became essentially the logo for The Watchmen is a yellow smiley face. Mm-hmm. And then there's a splash of blood on it, which you can see on the cover. Anyway, so she makes she makes these eggs into the shape of a smiley face, just a little bit, just a little nod.
So could you explain this theme of like, or is this just? I would really want to know, like, what if this is meaningful, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's a sort of a throwaway scene where she's discussing these eggs, and there's like some symbolism, but there's not much more deeper here. Like, I don't know. I would be interested to know, like, as someone, you've seen the whole series, is there some sort of deeper meaning about separating and building walls and having that being important?
I think that's a theme of the show. I mean, clearly there are separations between the police, you know, and and the regular citizenry, because they all wear masks. There are very clearly good guys and bad guys. There will very much be a theme of race. I mean, it starts out with the Tulsa Massacre. I can't imagine what's more race-driven than that. So this is just a subtle nod to the fact that race is going to be a theme in this. I wouldn't read too much into her exact words.
Maybe it's her character that's kind of... She seems to be pretty vindictive and... She has, you know, she has a vendetta of some sort. So it may be remnant or reflective of her character specifically, maybe not the show as a whole. I don't know, but
she definitely has some history, and she goes into it a little bit right here. Actually, she makes mention that she used to be a police officer, but she's not anymore. And one of the students asked her why. And she says that she was attacked as part of the White Knight, which is where a bunch of 7th Cavalry members rose up and went to the homes of police officers and attacked them and basically killed them. The White Knight, that event is what ultimately spawned the idea of cops wearing masks so that wouldn't happen again. So it was a protection measure enacted after that. Clearly, she survives that, so she did not get assassinated. It does come up in the show. We actually see later exactly what happens, and it's pretty crazy. So she definitely has a vendetta, specifically against the 7th Cavalry, because she was part of this White Knight. A couple quick things I want to mention around the classroom. On the wall, we see the Anatomy of a Squid poster. Squids are going to be a major theme because that was ultimately the finale of the comic. We see a Four Important President poster, and it has Lincoln, Washington, Nixon, and Redford. So we do, we know, I don't know if we know yet, but I'll spoil it, that Robert Redford is president in this universe. And I think by the end of the episode, I think they tell us he's been president for 30 years. So he's been president for a long time.
Oh, I never got that, but I did get that explanation from you from our last episode, kind of explaining. And they mention Redfordations or
Redfordations.
Redfordations in, right here. So I was like, that's that's some sort of weird reference to Robert Redford and reparations.
Right.
Mix of...
Yeah, that's definitely a theme. What exactly Redfordations are, isn't clear yet, but they are controversial, which is why that boy brings it up. It's a point of contention. But it's worth noting that in the list of presidents, of important presidents, Redford and Nixon both made the list along with Lincoln and Washington. Angela tells us that she was born in Vietnam, and she is teaching them how to make some Vietnamese cookies. The teacher asks her, were you born there before or after it became a state? So if you remember from the previous episode in the original comic, Dr. Manhattan goes to Vietnam. He's sent by the president, and we win Vietnam because Dr. Manhattan is super powerful. And in this universe, Vietnam becomes a state. So there are more than 50 states in this universe, and that will come up later. You will see American flags that do not look like our American flag because they have more stars. Mm. And there's a quick mention of the Redfordations, and then Topher basically beats that kid up and they get sent home. So while we are driving, we see them driving home. They hear an air raid siren in the car. I'm talking about Angela and Topher. And so she pulls the car over like you would pull over if an ambulance was passing you. And then all of a sudden from the inside of the car, we see tons and tons and tons of baby squids rain from the sky and basically cover everything. So something weird is going on in this universe because squids fall from the sky and there's not really any explanation. And it's so... frequent, I guess, is the right word, that they have air raid sirens and that they are used to it. Doesn't particularly cause any damage. It's just really messy, I would imagine. Oh, the one thing I want to make mention. So this is episode one. In the very first scene we see with Angela Abar, she is baking eggs, right?
Mm-hmm.
when we get to episode 9, we get to the very last scene. Just remember eggs. Eggs will also play a theme in this show.
Mm. Okay.
We see, then it cuts. Angela has made it home. They've cleaned off their car, got the squids off of it, and her daughter is hosing squids off of the sidewalk. Her husband basically kind of is a little frustrated with her and hands her a pager. She does not have a cell phone. So they have electric cars and advanced technology in this world, but they still use pagers. I don't think we see any cell phones, and I don't think we see any reference to the internet either. So this is clearly a different universe than ours. And on her cell phone, it says Little Bighorn, which is a secret code that Angela understands. Her husband does not. And she says, I got to go right now. I have to go to the bakery. Do you know, again, history is not my forte. Do you know what Little Bighorn is?
No. Mm-mm.
Little Bighorn was Custer's last stand. So Little Bighorn is where Custer died. And it was an armed engagement between the combined forces of the Lakota Sioux, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho tribes against the 7th Cavalry Regiment of the United States Army. So it was three Native American tribes against a section of the army called the 7th Cavalry, which is interesting to note because the 7th Cavalry is alive and well in this universe in the form of the Rorschach masks. So the Rorschach mask people are essentially descendants of the 7th Cavalry people from Custer's Last Stand. And they are, I think it would be analogous to how people talk today about how, you know, the South should have won the Civil War and they still, you know, have Don't Tread on Me flags and Confederate flags. So that's sort of where the 7th Cavalry comes from. But it does have a it roots in real U.S. history.
Hmm. Okay.
We see Angela going to her bakery, or she's heading downtown to get to her bakery. And we see a guy spinning a sign, and the sign says, "The future is bright," and he's very happy. And Rorschach, when he was not wearing his mask, his name was Walter Kovacs, and he would go out on the street and carry a sign much like this guy, but it said the end is near. So he was very much a doom and gloom kind of guy. So this is a nod to essentially the opposite of Rorschach. And as she's walking into her bakery, there's a quick cut of a newspaper in the foreground. Somebody's reading a newspaper, and the newspaper has three headlines that are of interest. One says, "Veidt officially declared dead." So Veidt was the bad guy from the comic. So if we're doing our math and the comic was in 1985 and this is in 2019, that's 34 years. And they're just now declaring him dead. So
is that Ozymandias?
Yes, Ozymandias and Veidt are the same person. Okay. Like Adrian Veidt is his real name and his, you know, superhero name is Ozymandias. One of the other headlines on the newspaper was KKK vandalism forces closure of Statue of Liberty, and Boise squid shower destroys homeless camp, kills two.
Mm.
Angela is just about to go into her bakery, and her bakery is named Milk and Hanoi, which is just a reference to Vietnam, which I thought was a good, you know, pun. And just she's about to go in the door, we see an old guy in a wheelchair. And he says, "Hey, when is that bakery going to be open? Because it's not open to the public. It's like she's in the process of, you know, building it, essentially, and it's locked." And she just kind of blows this guy off. She says, "Oh, a couple months." And then as she's going in the door, he says, "Do you think I could lift 200 pounds? And she turns around and looks at him like, you know, he's this old decrepit guy and he's in a wheelchair. Like, what the heck is going on? And she just kind of blows him off. It does come back later, so I just want to note that he does ask her if he can lift 200 pounds. We see Angela suit up in a superhero montage. She, you know, gets her cape and hood and a couple weapons, you know, and then she hauls ass out of the alley behind her bakery in this black car. She drives past a Williams Dreamland Theater, which is the rebuilt theater from 1921 Tulsa, where the little boy was watching the Bass Reeves movie. The sign out front of the Dreamland Theater says, "Rodgers and Hammerstein, Oklahoma, final performance directed by Tessa Hurston." So they are playing Oklahoma at this theater. she gets in her car and she drives into a mobile home park, which is called Nixonville. So in this universe, Richard Nixon was extremely popular because he won Vietnam for us. And I think he was president for 5 terms or something like that. So there's these little communities that love Nixon. In fact, there's a statue outside of Nixonville, like of him, you know, doing his 2-finger salute. And I did note that one of the mobile homes has Fuck Redford painted on, like spray painted on the side of it. So there are clearly factions here. Angela, who's all dressed up, her superhero alter ego, her name is Sister Knight. So she's kind of unrecognizable now. She has a face mask and a hood on. She basically just kicks her way into this mobile home, punches this, you know, guy straight in the face, and then that's it. It cuts. We find out later that she has put that guy in her trunk and she has taken him back to police headquarters, and they're going to interrogate him.
Yeah, and I did want to note on this whole like superhero introduction of this character that I really kind of like the kind of unglamorousness of it. It's like it's not jacked up with lens flares or slow-mo or like clean environments. It's very real and kind of, you know, low rent, and you don't get the sense that she's got a lot of fame and fortune being like a Sister Knight superhero. You know, she has a, like a reputation with the local police, but it's like nothing more beyond that. And I like that it's kind of a local story, very much centered on Tulsa, Oklahoma, it seems like. So I do appreciate that. I just wanted to point that out. I like kind of like the vibe of the superheroes and the action. It you know, I think it appeals to what I, if there's something I liked about the comic, it felt, you know, gritty and unusual and like unglamorous. You know, there was I think that was really what it was going for, was taking the glamour out of superheroes. Or like vigilantes or whatever you want to call these people, and not making it like a nice idealistic thing. So I like what they're. I think I like this much better than the movie, for instance, that kind of I thought made it too glamorous. You know,
I think Watchmen was probably a direct response to, you know, your Justice Leagues of the time, where you've got Superman and Batman and Aquaman and Wonder Woman, and they're all just fighting crime and they all get along and nothing ever goes poorly, right? You know, mm-hmm. The Watchmen was very much about, you know, like you said, the real people behind the masks that do this, and they have flaws and they argue and they don't get along and they have egos. And I mean, ultimately, you know, one of them sexually assaults one of the other ones. So it's not all sunshine and rainbows. And yeah, I mean, it's a little bit gritty, but it's realistic. It doesn't sensationalize, or it doesn't, you know, paper over that, you know, if you're going out and fighting crime and doing these things, like that you're going to be a little bit broken. I mean, most people don't want to go out on the streets and put themselves in the line of danger for no reason, right? I mean, Superman doesn't get paid. Batman doesn't get paid. Like, you'd kind of have to be a sociopath to want to go do that. So it puts a human face on that a little bit, or at least it elicits, you know, some of the consequences that would happen if you did do that.
Yeah, I think there's like there's a real problem with like just sort of a haze of like superhero heroes and villains and all this like idealism, you know, that gets tied up in all of that. The Watchmen specifically is kind of trying to break down and you know, wash away some of our, I think maybe that's, you know, that, I don't know for sure. I just assume maybe that's one of its objectives, is like to wake us up to like this idea of heroes and villains and good guys and bad guys. You know, I always like shows like that, or stories that kind of show the realness of villains and show the flaws of the heroes and show that like it's not black and white, you know. So, yeah, I do appreciate that aspect of the show.
You have to understand the time that Watchmen came out. So Watchmen came out in, I think we said 85. Or that was the events. I think it came out in 89. It's not important, but it came out in the 80s. The point is that superhero comics in the late 80s and 90s, it was completely different than it is today, right? Like, I mean, we've got Marvel movies coming out all the time. You know, my dad goes and watches Marvel movies. Like, it's mainstream and it's common or it's popular, and it would not be weird to see, you know, a 40-year-old guy like myself going to the comic book store and dropping $50 on a shiny, well put together Batman book. When the Watchmen came out, that was not a thing. Comics were targeted at little kids by and large. So the stories that target little kids, it has to be very clear. It has to be black and white. You can't have a gray area because kids don't understand that. So you had your Supermans, who was very clearly the good guy. You got your Lex Luthor, who's very clearly the bad guy, right? When we talked about this with Star Wars, like Darth Vader is black and Obi-Wan's robes are white. It's very clear who the good and the bad guy was. So that's what superhero comics were, essentially. You know, there were indie comics and there were offshoots, but they were certainly not mainstream. So when The Watchmen came out, it was appealing to a different audience. And yeah, it was to show that, hey, this isn't realistic, that this is fantasy, and that's fine, but we need to acknowledge that that there's no way the Justice League would really work like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now that Sister Knight is at police headquarters, she walks in and she sees that they are essentially showing a video. All the police, you know, are in this, I don't know, meeting room. And they are showing the 7th Cavalry's manifesto video. And they have, I assume, you know, mailed in a VHS tape. I don't know, because the internet and YouTube aren't a thing. And they're basically just, you know, spouting off. I don't want to go into the whole thing. But there is, in the video, they make mention that soon all the whores and race traitors will shout, "Save us," and we will whisper, "No." And that is almost word for word what Rorschach says in the original comic. They have spun his words to suit themselves. They bring up whores and race traitors. Rorschach was a little more nuanced in his telling. I think he says, soon all the world will shout, "Save us," and we will whisper, "No." So again, the 7th Cavalry has spun off of Rorschach's ideas. And the video of the 7th Cavalry is pretty alarming. They're basically telling everybody, stay out of our way, specifically the cops, like, it's going to be bad news. Clearly, it's already started because they executed that cop on the street, but it's ramping up. Judd addresses all of the cops and mentions that there have been 3 years of peace, but they were just hibernating, referring to the 7th Cavalry. So the 7th Cavalry aren't new. They are definitely on the police radar, but they have been not doing anything for 3 years, certainly not killing cops. We see, and I just want to call them out by name. So there are a ton of nameless, faceless police officers that just wear yellow masks. There's probably 60 of them in this scene. But there are four, I want to say, cop extraordinaires. So we've seen Sister Knight. She is one. There's another cop named Pirate Jenny. There is a Russian guy named Red Scare. And then Panda is also here. And Panda is the one that Sutton had to call to get his weapon unlocked. So those four will definitely play a big part in the show. The cops, in response to one of their own being gunned down, they want a 24-hour weapons release because they kind of want to go out and go vigilante on the streets as revenge for this cop getting killed. Panda is very reluctant, I would say, and he starts quoting the rule book about why they should do that, mentions Article 4. Ultimately, he gets outvoted, and the police are given a 24-hour weapons release. And Judd, the police chief, ends the meeting by saying, and I'm going to totally butcher this because it's Latin. He says, quis custodiat ipsos custodes, which is the Latin phrase for who watches the watchman. And that's a big theme. It's actually spray painted on the walls in several scenes of the original comic. And ultimately, at its heart, I think that's what the Watchmen is about, is who is in charge of watching the people that are supposed to be protecting us. So in this case, it's the police. In the case of the Watchmen, who's watching the Watchmen? Who is checking the power of these people that have all of the power, right? That's It's a famous Latin phrase from a million years ago, but it really is just saying that you can't give unlimited power to the police or the government or someone in a position of power. There needs to be some sort of check and a balance, or things will get way out of whack. Judd says that, and then the police sort of all together as a response, they say, nos custodimus, which means we watch them. So the police in this universe have a different, I don't know what the word is, a different goal than I would say modern police.
I tried to look up that term, nos custodimus. And I was getting weird answers like, we keep it warm bathrobes.
That's the alternate. Yeah, that's the alternate meaning.
Is sure. that the other one?
Yeah.
There was one that a common phrase, nos custodimus quod lingus. We guard what you lick. maybe that's, you know, the extension of what they were saying, you know. okay, but that makes more sense. I guess they watch the watchers.
I'm not really sure why the cops say what they do. I mean, again, the theme is that you need to keep power checked or it will grow exponentially. And so the cops are saying, you know, that they're going to be watching the 7th Cavalry. I'm not sure. But the point is that that's what's going on, is that everyone is watching or should be watching the people in power. We cut real quick, and Angela is in Judd's office, and she is mad that he didn't call her earlier, you know, at whatever, 2 o'clock in the morning when the cop got killed. And it's worth noting that she's sitting on his desk with her feet up on his desk, and she is drinking coffee out of an owl coffee mug. And Night Owl was one of the main characters in the original Watchmen, so I think that was just a quick nod to that character. She mentions that she has a guy in her trunk. He was just about to send people out. And I think he just did send people out to go bring in people to investigate. She basically says, oh, I already got one. And he's like, what? How did you know how to do that? She was like, I just knew. And he asked her, he says, how do you know he's 7th Cavalry? And her response is great. She says, I got a nose for white supremacy and he smells like bleach. And then they basically go and get this guy out of her trunk, and they put him in what's called the pod. And it's kind of this spherical looking device, like an interrogation chamber, and looking glass is in there. And there he's got the suspect chained to the chair, and the suspect asks for a lawyer, and looking glass responds, we don't have to do that with terrorists. And he turns on the spear. So it's sort of like, I don't know, how do you describe that thing? It's sort of like an IMAX movie, like it kind of wraps all around him, right?
Yeah, it's very like a very cinematic way to torture someone.
Yeah. And he turns on the spear. So there's kind of these weird images flashing behind him. I wrote down some of the ones that were more interesting. It starts out kind of tame. We see at least like a wheat field, a Texaco gas station, a milk ad. And then it starts getting a little more, I want to say like Americana. We see the moon landing. We see a cowboy on a horse. We see that famous flaming monk that burned himself. We see the Confederate flag. We see Mount Rushmore with Nixon added to it. We see the famous American Gothic painting. We see a giant squid eyeball. We see like flaming crosses, Nazi flags, Rorschach masks, essentially all those things are flashing by while Looking Glass is basically rapid fire asking him questions. They're trying to suss out if he is part of the 7th Cavalry or not. He just basically repeats, are you a member of or do you associate with members of the white supremacist or right supremacist organization known as the 7th Cavalry? So like you said, it has these images are flashing up that are kind of jarring, and they're flashing quickly, and he's asking you questions really quickly, and it's designed to throw the suspect off. Looking Glass comes out of the pod, and he says, you know, is he 7th Cavalry or not? And he says, well, he didn't break, but I know he is, and I know he knows something about what happened.
I mean, to get serious about this, like, kind of scene, I think my concerns might just get steamrolled. But, I mean, in general, when you're talking about race in America, like, this is a very serious topic. And typically, the police represent the state, which upholds the oppression of minorities, specifically black people, to a large extent. I mean, so to throw that on its head is just a bit wild for me, and I want to see a good reason for it. You know, they use these interrogation tactics here that to me aren't justified yet. I mean, like, obviously they seem to be like a terrorist group, but like, do they not need to treat them like, you know, innocent until proven guilty, deserving of legal representation? Right after this interrogation, Angela takes her into a room and does the Jack Bauer, you know, situation, and just starts, you know, wailing on him.
Yeah, she like apologizes to him. She's like, I'm really sorry I came at you so hard. And then he was like, oh, okay, yeah, thanks. And then she just throws him into this room, closes the door, and beats the crap out of the guy, right?
Yeah.
You see, like, water and with blood in it leak under the door, and she's just yelling, yeah, you said Jack Bauer style, where is he? Yeah, so
yeah.
The thing that you don't know yet, I mean, you know a little bit about the White Knight, and so what happened was that all the 7th Cavalry came to multiple cops' homes, you know, whatever, in the middle of the night, and just straight up executed them. So these cops have a real serious history with the 7th Cavalry, so they have a very short leash with any shenanigans, I would say, from them. So more will come out later, but yes, they have no... They got zero fucks to give when it comes to the 7th Cavalry, clearly, because they've basically tortured the hell out of this guy and drug him out of his house with no explanation and locked him in a trunk and yeah.
Yeah, so it's an interesting juxtaposition that definitely throws me off a bit, but I guess it makes me definitely curious to see what this world is very different in some core fundamental ways, it seems.
While Angela is off screen, essentially beating the crap out of this guy, she does manage to get him to say something about a cattle ranch. So that's where they head next. They get some information and they head out to they're in this field. We see Pirate Jenny, Red Scare, Sister Knight, and Judd are at this farm field. And there's cows going all through this field, and it's night. It's pitch black. We cut inside, and we see the 7th Cavalry. There's four of them sitting around like a poker table, and they are removing batteries from watches. They have a big, gigantic bowl of batteries, like watch batteries. So they're small, but there are, I mean, a couple hundred in there, and they're just going through watches and pulling these batteries out. While we see them pulling the batteries out, they have a motion sensor on the farm, so all of a sudden the 7th Cavalry is alerted that someone is at the farm, and they all arm themselves. They pick up guns and whatnot, and they pass out pills, just these white pills. They pass out white cyanide pills. They run outside and they jump up on this big pickup truck, presumably the pickup truck that was in the opening scene that killed Sutton, and the implication being that he didn't want the cop to look into his lettuce in the back of his truck because there's a big gigantic Gatling gun in the back of the truck.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
They just start opening fire into this herd of cows. I mean, cows are just getting destroyed. All the, you know, I would say the heroes, I don't know what you want to call Sister Knight and her group. They all hit the floor, and they're basically hiding behind these cow carcasses while these huge Gatling bullets are flying by and hitting the cows and whatnot. We see a couple of the 7th Cavalry members run to like a small prop plane, and they attempt to escape. As the Gatling gun is reloading, Angela basically just rushes the truck, jumps up, shoots one guy point blank in the chest, and basically chases this other 7th Cavalry guy inside, and they have, you know, a melee fight inside. They punch each other, throw each other around. Just when she gets the drop on this guy, he's on the ground and she's starting to interrogate him, and you see him and he has that white pill on his tongue, and he swallows it, and it's really fast acting, because I think, you know, he dies, he starts spitting up foam, you know, in 10 seconds or whatever. So rather than be interrogated by the police, these 7th Cavalry members have taken their own life. While she is sort of like recovering from watching this guy kill himself, she looks up and she sees on the wall there's an old bank poster. And it was an ad for a bank, and the slogan was, "We keep the riffraff out." And we see one of the original Watchmen, one of the original Minutemen from the Watchmen comic back in the day, and his name was Dollar Bill. And he kind of looks like Captain America, but instead of having an A on his chest, he has a dollar sign. And he's holding this black guy by the scruff of his neck. So there's this very, you know, kind of racist poster about, you know, essentially keeping the black people out of the banks, that Angela kind of stares at, which very apropos for what you would see from the 7th Cavalry, you know, having it on the wall, but it gives her pause, like, oh, okay, these are the idiots that I'm dealing with. And it's, you know, the poster was probably from the 50s, so I mean, this is like a 60, 70-year-old poster, and they've kept it around just because they liked the theme. The 7th Cavalry plane takes off. They're going to escape, and we cut to Judd and Pirate Jenny, and they are in Archie, or they're in a replica, or a recreation, I suppose, of Archie, which is this owl-shaped, or it's a, I don't know if the plane is the right word, but it's an aircraft, and it has two big glass windows in the front, and they look like kind of like owl eyes, and that is the character that, or the ship that the Night Owl makes in the original comic. So I believe it's mentioned later in the series that the government has contracted some of Night Owl's plans, and they may have recreated some of these aircraft. Ultimately, this experimental aircraft, this Archie, it's named after Archimedes from the original comic, because he was a big fan. Archimedes was Merlin's owl. So there's definitely an owl theme. Night Owl was big into that. And this plane shoots a gigantic flamethrower, you know, I don't know, probably 40 feet out, and it catches the 7th Cavalry plane on fire. And you know, they stop the 7th Cavalry from escaping. Ultimately, Archie loses control and they crash. But Judd and Pirate Jenny do survive. There's a little bit of delay there. There's some tension about whether or not they survived. It's worth noting that, again, in this universe, we are in a futuristic universe with, you know, battery-powered cars and things like that. But even this, you know, experimental aircraft, it has a flamethrower on it. It has a very real weapon. And that's actually a throwback to the original comic. At one point, they use a flamethrower as well. So there's no lasers, there's no missiles, there's no, right? So this is very, I want to say, low-tech, high-tech. And then, you know, Angela and Judd and everybody are happy because they've taken out 7th Cavalry and no one has died. And then we cut, and I'm curious what your take on this is. The next scene, we see an English countryside, we see a castle, and then we see a guy on horseback ride up, and it's Jeremy Irons, famous actor, so pretty recognizable. What do you think, what went through your mind when you saw this?
Well, like you said, right before that, they were like celebrating and kind of happy. I actually really liked that moment. They kind of started laughing about it, you know, a little levity and this, like, you know, not taking themselves too seriously. You know, real quick, I like that. But yeah, the English countryside castle, man, with assistants that don't know the difference between a knife and a horseshoe.
Right. So he pulls up on the horse and a guy comes up and says, "Welcome home, master." Right.
Yeah.
And then we see this gentleman, he is sitting essentially naked at a typewriter. And there's a woman there and she's massaging his thighs because his thighs are raw from riding the horse too much. And then we see there are two people. There's Miss Crookshanks, which is the woman that's massaging his legs. And then there's Mr. Phillips, who is the guy that, you know, took the horse away. Do you get the impression that this is in the same time period as the Angela 7th Cavalry stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't perceive it as a different time period. They didn't show any dates or anything that say, like, okay, this is 40 years, you know, in the past or anything like that. I just assumed it's some crazy rich English dude. I mean, I think they say he's Veidt or
they do not say that he's Veidt.
They don't?
I don't think they say in this episode. I don't know, do they? I don't remember. So the point is that it's not clear where they are in time or space. It just cuts to the English countryside, which is a very different setting than we've seen before. The only reason I ask is because I remember when I first watched this, I was like, who is this? What time is this? Because, you know, he's riding a horse. He's not driving a car. There's no electricity in the castle. He's using a manual typewriter. So there's, I don't want to say clues. That's not the right word because it's not a mystery. I guess it is a mystery. There's a lot of things here that may lead you astray. So I'm just curious where you thought this was.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea what was going on here, basically. I thought I saw the name Veidt. But maybe
searched not. The entire closed captioning, and the word "Veidt" is not in the it's not Veidt. It's not mentioned in the thing.
Okay.
Remember from the newspaper that Veidt has been declared dead. So what did we say this is? 34 years after. So I want to say Veidt was in his 30s in the original comic. So if he were alive and still doing his thing, he would be 64. He would be in his 60s in this. This gentleman appears to be about the right age. And if you had seen the original Adrian Veidt from the comic, you would realize that this character, that Jeremy Irons, looks similar. So that was certainly my first reaction too, was that that this is going to be Adrian and that somehow he's, you know, gone on from attempting to destroy the world that now he's living in an English castle or who knows. But it's not clear yet who this character is. His servants, I guess, Miss Crookshanks and Mr. Phillips, they bring out they bring out a cake and they say it's a special occasion. It's your anniversary. And they don't say what it's an anniversary of, but they just mentioned that it's an anniversary. And then they also, it's worth noting that the cake is purple and yellow, which were very much the Adrian Veidt colors. So there's a little bit more foreshadowing that this might be Veidt. And the cake has one candle on it. And when this character asks for a knife to cut the cake, Mr. Phillips hands him a horseshoe instead. And Adrian is confused and disappointed that this person has given him a horseshoe instead of a knife. Mr. Phillips also gives him a present that's wrapped in an animal hide, and it's a pocket watch. And it was, I think at one point, doesn't he mention that you had it when you arrived and that it was broken and I repaired it or something like that?
Yeah, discarded it. He discarded it. I don't know.
Something, yeah. So the pocket watch is working, and clocks and time are definitely a theme in the Watchmen universe, so watch for the clocks and watch for things that look like clocks that, you know, have a specific time on them. I watched this like six times to try and see if I was getting this wrong, but the stopwatch that Phillips gives him is set to 750. And it is running, so it's not broken. It's very common. Again, the Watchmen comic was written during the Cold War when they had that doomsday clock that they kept showing that we were 5 minutes away from nuclear Armageddon or whatever. So there was a lot of clocks that were set to 11:55 in the Watchmen universe. I kind of expected to see that here, but it wasn't.
Hmm.
This character mentions that I'm writing a play and I want you to play the leading roles. And the play is titled The Watchmaker's Son. And Dr. Manhattan was, I don't even remember what his human name was. I forget now. But he was the Watchmaker's son. So his father was a watchmaker, and that's where a lot of the time themes come from, the original Watchmen. So the implication here is that he is essentially writing a play about Dr. Manhattan, but we don't know for sure what that means yet.
Hmm.
And then that's it. And then it cuts to dinner at Judd's house, and Angela and her husband and her kids are over. They are reciting presidents, and I need to look this up. But they make mention of Nixon, which we already knew about. They make mention of Ford, and then they make mention of Redford. So I need to post on the subreddit and see if somehow Gerald Ford made the cut in this universe. I don't even know how that's possible. If Nixon was president for 5 terms and Redford's been president for 30 years, that doesn't leave any time for Ford. Anyway, I thought it was interesting that they're still talking about presidents because they want you to know that that Redford is president now. Judd offers to go get some more wine. They need another bottle of wine. And while he's in the kitchen, he does a bump of Coke, which apparently is just totally normal because Angela signals to him like, hey, you got a little on your nose. Like nobody seems to care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it's mentioned that Judd played Curly, who was the star of Oklahoma in high school. So he knows these musical lyrics and he starts singing to the family. I have actually never seen Oklahoma. I should ask my wife. I believe that Judd is actually the bad guy, or he's definitely not one of the main characters. So there may be a subtle nod here about him being in that play. We cut to the outside of the exterior of the house, and Angela is explaining to Judd that they got a duffel bag full of batteries from the 7th Cavalry plane that they shot down. And I think Judd said, well, what do they need batteries for? You know, why were they getting these watch batteries? You know, couldn't they just go buy batteries? And she says, no, they're the old kind. They're synthetic lithium batteries, the ones that were making people sick. So essentially there were these, I guess, watch batteries that they have now banned because they were giving people cancer, I believe. And for some reason, the 7th Cavalry wants those old watch batteries. Actually, I just realized that's interesting because all those batteries came from watches. Huh. A lot of watch and clock stuff going on. I didn't put that together when I was watching it the first time. We cut to the interior of Judd's house. Angela and her family have left. Judd gets a call from the governor, and the governor is concerned about reprisals after this cop was killed, especially now that the cops have a 24-hour weapons release. You know, Judd tells him, oh, nothing to worry about. Don't you worry about, like, okay, sure, whatever, buddy. While that's playing on the TV in the background, we see an ad for the OG Minutemen. So, like, the Minutemen they were the Justice League of the Watchmen universe. So Rorschach and his buddies, they were in a group called the Minutemen. And we see that there is I don't know if documentary is the right word, but they're doing a show on the old superhero faction from the 90s, and they're advertising the heck out of it. So there's going to be essentially, I guess, like they're going to out a lot of these people, and it becomes pretty sensational. We see, or Judd gets a page, again, pagers, no cell phones, no nothing else, that Sutton has woken up at the hospital, the cop that was shot. And he's going to go visit this police officer who's now awake in his truck. His wife says, no, you can't go out there. And he says, no, don't worry, I'll take a police escort. And then he goes outside, walks right past his escort, and just gets in the truck, and he's like going to drive himself to the hospital. So while he's driving, to the hospital, he is listening to the radio. He's listening to talk radio, and he's essentially listening to right-wing talk radio. There is mention of Senator Joe Keen. I don't know if you remember from the last time. Senator Keen was the one that passed the Keen Act, which outlawed costumed vigilantes going out and doing their own thing, so that all the superheroes basically had to register with the government and become essentially police officers if that's what they wanted to do. So the radio announcer mentions basically how badass Joe Keen is and how Robert Redford is, you know, lame, and it's time to, you know, for a change in leadership. And he mentions again that Redford has been president for 30 years. So they're building up this character of Joe Keen, who is, I believe, the son. I don't think it's the grandson. I believe it's the son of Senator Keen from the original comics, and that kind of got this whole ball rolling. And the radio announcer calls Redford the Sun Dancer in Chief. And it's a reference for one of two things I couldn't figure it out. Robert Redford was in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, so it could be a reference to that. And then I also found that Robert Redford founded the Sundance Film Festival. So I don't even – maybe the Sundance Film Festival is named after Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. I don't know. But the point is that he calls him the Sundancer in Chief. As a put down, he's not happy with Robert Redford. And while they're driving, he gets that flat tire, or his tires explode or whatever. And Judd seems like not concerned about it, like, at all. He gets out of the truck, looks at his front tire, looks at his back tire, realize they are completely flat, you know, not like a little bit, but like, and the alarm bells don't go off. Like, he doesn't put two and two together. He walks back on the road and then he sees, what are those things called? I don't know. You know, like the spike traps that cops put out.
Yeah.
And so clearly somebody has laid this out to pop the tires on his truck. And even then he was kind of like, huh, that's kind of weird. And then a flashlight gets shined at him, and then that's it. So, like, as far as, you know, cops go, like, this guy has very little, like, actual cop sense. I just thought it was kind of surprising where he was, he was unconcerned. Well, okay, I don't want to say anything because maybe I do know where that's going. But,
well, so, okay, I guess I want to say something about, like, where this type of show takes me. And this is like a very Damon Lindelof sort of effect for me, and it's a problem for me because there's so many unanswered things building up, so many weird things that are unexplained. I can go through everything that I don't understand, but then you start to wonder, like, if character motivations are, like, this character's motivation in this scene is makes sense in some unknown way, and, you know, as, because so much of the show is unknown, so I'm just kind of getting thrown for a loop. Nothing is making sense.
Can I?
And then, yes. Anyway, so
if I'm reading between the lines, you're concerned that there are, you're having Lost style concerns where there are too many open thread points that they will never be able to explain them all, and then you will be left unsatisfied. Is that what you're taking away from this?
Yeah, but it's more that certain character motivation. So this scene that you're describing of this cop not acting like a cop, and they don't. He doesn't seem to exhibit any character, like, depth as far as, like, what a cop would do, what, you know, what this character should be acting like in this scene. And so I'm thrown off the scent of what this show is trying to portray, because I want to interpret these characters like they're being portrayed. I want to interpret them in the way that that is on the text, and so this should be a well-respected, talented, good sheriff who has obviously has command of his team, should be a good cop, act in this way, which, you know, doesn't make sense, but then it's kind of swept into this whole confusion about all of these elements that also don't make sense. So it's a criticism I have of this style of filmmaking where you can just kind of throw everything. Anything can be confusing because it's like supposedly part of the style of it. So, you know, maybe this particular character scene will be explained later, but this, maybe not, you know, I don't know.
It is definitely a style of this type of storytelling to set up a lot of mysteries and leave you guessing. I will say I definitely had that feeling with Lost, like, oh my gosh, like, why is there a polar bear here? And how did they, you know, why is this boat here? And those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And when the show was over, I was frustrated because they did not tie up probably 50% of the plot threads. That was not an issue with this show. I was concerned going into the last couple, like, oh my gosh, they're not going to wrap this up. They're going to pull Lost all over and I'm going to be frustrated. I was not frustrated at the end. You will get, I mean, I can't say that every character is perfect and everyone has perfect motivation, but I will say that a lot of the things that are confusing at the beginning are explained at least in a satisfactory fashion. So,
yeah,
let's circle back on that in a couple episodes. I'm curious if you're still frustrated, but I will tell you that it is very much fleshed out.
Hmm.
If you watched the show that he did before this was The Leftovers. I think you and I talked about that. You watched The Leftovers, right?
Part of it, yeah. I didn't finish it, but yeah.
But a lot of the storytelling in that is similar to this, right? It's a mystery,
yeah.
And why did they get from A to B? Why are all these people smoking, and why aren't they talking? And, like, you get the feeling, like, this doesn't make any sense. This is just weird for the sake of weird, right?
Yeah.
But it does wrap up. So you'll get at least a satisfactory conclusion. I think.
Well, I trust you, and so we're in it together, and you're going to lead me along through this journey.
Okay? I'll drag you kicking and screaming. All right, so there's basically two super quick scenes. Let's wrap this up, and then we'll talk about the themes. So we cut real quick to Angela and her husband Cal, and they're basically having like really passionate sex in her closet, and then her cell phone rings. She doesn't want to get it, but ultimately they stop and get it, and she answers her phone, and someone – oh, I guess it's not her cell phone because they don't have cell phones in this. It must have been
Can I be explicit about this scene? Okay. She says she's almost there, and they're just having, like, vaginal sex.
Yeah.
So I think that's bullshit. It's very rare that a woman will be able to get to a climax with vaginal sex.
You don't know how good Cal is.
Okay, that's fair.
Really, there's a lot going on in this first episode.
Maybe that's revealed later.
That's what your nitpick is?
Maybe that's revealed later. Yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Well, I'm open to explanations. That's my number. That's my number one issue with the show.
Wow. Okay.
Sex education. Yep.
All right. So she stops and answers her phone, and it's a voice, and he says, "I want to meet you. I've got some information about your police chief." And he wants to meet her at this tree at the end of some road that she knows where it is or whatever. But so she hangs up the phone. She immediately drops onto her bed and like pushes the headboard back. And there's a hidden shotgun in there, which was kind of badass. And then she hands Cal a pistol and tells him to shoot anyone other than me that gets anywhere close to the porch. She is in panic mode and she takes off. So she gets in her car. I don't remember. Is she dressed like Sister Night when she goes to the tree? I don't think so. I don't know. It's not important.
No, I think she just comes from her house.
Yeah, because she just comes
quickly.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
So she pulls up to this tree, and you can see like the silhouette of the tree because it's big, but there's whoever this is shining a really bright light in her eyes, and you can't see anything other than that she is at this tree in this field in the dark. She threatens to... she's like, I'm just going to start shooting if you don't turn that light off because, you know, you're blinding me. And the light goes off. And, hey, it's wheelchair guy. It's the wheelchair guy from outside of her store. And he's just kind of hanging out at this in this field in the middle of nowhere. And Judd is strung up and he is hanging from the tree. and he's looking pretty dead. And the wheelchair guy, it cuts to, you know, a close-up on the wheelchair guy, and we see that he, I don't know if he pulls it out of his pocket or he already has it in his hand, but he has the paper from the original scene that said, watch over this boy. So this, the implication being that this is the older version of the character from the intro. So if we do the math on that little boy, because this takes place 98 years after the Tulsa 21 massacre, and assuming that boy was 4, 5, 6, so that makes this character, assuming it's the same boy, about 104, 105 years old.
Oh, okay.
We see, I did not pick that up the very first time I watched. Did you notice that he had the paper?
I did not. No, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah. I didn't either. I was 3 episodes in before I realized it was the same person. It's really subtle. Like it goes, because you're looking at his face, but if you happen to look at his lap, he has the paper that says, watch over this boy.
Huh.
And then it starts playing a song, and I don't know where this song, but the song is Poor Judd Fry is Dead. So Judd is, he's dead. He's hanging from this tree, and somehow the wheelchair guy is there. We don't know how he got Judd up in this tree. We don't know how he even got his wheelchair out in this field. There's no other vehicles that I saw, so it's kind of a mystery. And then the episode sort of fades out, or it's starting to fade out, and we hear a song from the original Oklahoma musical. And the song, one of the lyrics is, it's summer and we're running out of ice, which is the title of this episode. So that is where the title for this episode comes from. And the very last final scene that we see, we cut to Judd's sheriff badge on the grass, and presumably it's fallen off of his body, and it is sitting there on the grass, and the camera does a slow pan into it, and then a single drop of blood lands on the badge, and it's extremely reminiscent of the original Watchmen comedian smiley face with a drop of blood on it. And then star wipe fades out, and that's the end of the first episode. So what we see, like you said, is there's clearly there's a lot of mystery going on in this universe. There, you know, where do the squids come from? What's going on with all the masks? What's the Seventh Cavalry doing? You know, why are they? So there's a lot going on here. The analog to the original Watchmen comic is that issue one of the original comic, the comedian gets killed. So it's the 12-issue arc of the Watchmen is essentially a murder mystery. Who killed the comedian? But more importantly, why did they kill him? So this show opens essentially with a murder as well. And then the rest of it is a telling of why that happened and how did we get from A to B. So it's a murder mystery is the bottom line, much like the original.
But isn't comic. It kind of already kind of obvious who murdered him and why? I mean, isn't it already kind of evident? It's the
I'll give you $5 if you can tell me who killed him and why right now.
Well, I assume the show is communicating to me that it's the 7th Cavalry that had murdered him in retaliation for their attack.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to be what the show specifically is communicating pretty explicitly. I mean, there's some weirdness to it, but we only know one bad guy so far in the show, bad group. We know what's happened, the events that have happened, and they were attacked. There was a kind of a war started. I mean, I can't think any other than that, you know. So I don't know if there's a mystery for me at this point. It doesn't feel mysterious about who killed him and why.
Okay,
so that's my point.
Okay, I don't know how to respond without giving it away. If that were the case, the 7th Cavalry are horrible, horrible racists. Why would the wheelchair guy be there?
I assumed he found him, I guess. Like he somehow found him. Or maybe he was like put there by them as some sort of message.
Okay.
It seems weird, yes, but there's so many weird things happening in the show. That's also my point. Like, there's so many weird things that, like, all these other weird things keep building and building, and like my critical thinking skills start breaking down.
Well, I'll tell you what. Nothing in the show is what it seems to be. So, if it were that simple, it would be a very boring show, and we would not be having this conversation. So it gets a lot more interesting. And again, the who is way less important. What's really important is the why and how all the characters tie together. So
okay,
that's I don't want to go into too much more detail, because it's just how it all comes together is just, you know, an amazing, you know, chef's kiss of storytelling and mystery and leading you down one path, but really it's, you know, something else. So
nice. Well, okay. That's reassuring, because it does feel a little flat. Like in this first episode, I'm just like, okay, there's a lot of weird stuff happening, but there's no grand mystery that I'm being drawn into yet. I don't think, at least there's not one. I mean, there's one. It does seem like there's one in the background with maybe the squid stuff and like the, you know, he's talking to the governor at one point about these grander things. But like what's happening in the show feels very straightforward, I guess. Like I said, I just feel like this is a killing by the 7th Cavalry. It just seems like. So I guess the mystery so far, it hasn't been fully enticing.
There was one other thing, and I don't remember where in the episode it was. There was a quick shot of someone's TV, and we see, you know, what's essentially like a little blue figure, and he has, it kind of looks like a sandcastle, and he knocks down this sandcastle. So, I mean, it's very clearly a reference to Dr. Manhattan. So, at the end of the Watchmen comic, Dr. Manhattan leaves Earth voluntarily. You know, he basically is just fed up with humanity. Like, you guys are crazy. Like, I'm a god. I don't really need to deal with you anymore. And he goes to Mars. So we don't know what happens to him after that. So, I mean, there's whatever, 34 years between here and there. Dr. Manhattan is still in this universe somewhere. And he was on TV. You know, they're still showing things about Dr. Manhattan, but we don't know how or where he ties into all of this.
He's not in this first episode at all. I had I had no inclination that he was even going to be in the show or come back. Like, I understood he was part of the original comic. There's nothing in this first episode that indicates that he's going to be a character in the show.
He may not come back. I don't want to lead you down that road. I mean, that's one of the other mysteries, and you'll certainly see it in the first couple episodes, is they make mention of him. Yeah. You know, he shows up, you know, because people were very fond of Dr. Manhattan. I mean, he won the Vietnam War. So he is, I want to say, you know, a heroic figure to a lot of the populace of this world. And the fact that he is not there, I should say, he provides comfort, I think, to a lot of people, especially a lot of Americans, because when Dr. Manhattan is around, America, because he fights for our side, is essentially invincible, right? So there is a theme there of, where is Dr. Manhattan and is he going to save the day? Because he does essentially save the day in the original comic. So as the story unfolds, does he show up? Does he snap his fingers and everything is happy again? Or how do you play with that? Because I think, you know, Dr. Manhattan is a lot like Superman. He's invincible. He can't be killed. He can essentially, you know, I don't want to say travel through time, but he is aware of things outside of his own time. So how do you write a story? How do you write a character where one of the main characters in your story is a god and has no limitations? How do you make that an interesting story without just, you know, Dr. Manhattan shows up and you got a deus ex machina and everybody lives happily ever after? Like, no one would be happy with that. I wouldn't be happy with that. So the way the story unfolds and the role that the various older characters play in it are very interesting. None of the old characters, I would say, are main characters in this show. They all are secondary characters. Several of them make appearances. This is very much going to be the Sister Knight, you know, show, and, you know, 7th Cavalry show. Oh, and Looking Glass.
Do you think there should have been, like, some sort of, at least a tease, or, like, a little bit of an indication that, like, Dr. Manhattan is out there, and there's, you know, like, introduce it at maybe as just a Chekhov's gun type thing, like, oh, because there's like zero mention in this episode.
There's zero mention. I mean, there's very much a you see him. I mean, he's on somebody's TV, and I forget.
I didn't even see that. I didn't catch that.
Okay, I'll find it and I'll send you. You know, when he shows up, there is very much a Chekhov's gun with him. You see Dr. Manhattan, or you see this guy. So the presumption you see, it's this grainy footage on this TV. You see somebody on this, what you assume is a red planet. So you assume it's Dr. Manhattan on Mars. And in the original comic, he would make these really complex glass-like clock gear-looking, you know, structures out of the sand on Mars. Mm. So we know he has, you know, that sort of power. So the implication in this is that he is on Mars. He's because that's what he says he's going to do at the end of the comic, is that he's going to go to Mars and he's just going to build one of his glass castles and forget about humanity.
Yeah.
So that's what you see, this very blurry footage. You don't know if it's Dr. Manhattan. It could be doctored footage. It could just be some other blue guy. Who knows?
But it's not explicit. It's like in the background. It's something you have to catch.
100%. It's a Chekhov's gun, like you said. But it's not important yet. It becomes important later.
Okay.
All right. So that was episode one. There are eight more to go.
Well, okay. Let me just list the things that are to me a mystery, and then we can like see if these are answered. Okay. So refordation. I mean,
redfordations. Yes.
Redfordations.
Definitely explained.
Squid Rain.
Definitely explained.
Weird. Okay. Shiny mask dude and the pod. Okay. I mean, I guess I get the gist of it, but like, you know, we're just thrown into this and we have to assume what's going on.
His name is Looking Glass. Have some respect.
Looking Glass. Shiny mask dude. Okay.
Shiny.
Even the masks on the police officers, I get it's for safety, and I get there's that scene, or, you know, the telling of the White Knight.
It's in your defense, the White Knight story is super quick in this. It's just when Angela is in front of the class and she's explaining it there. If I hadn't have told you that the White Knight was related to the police wearing the masks, I would not expect you to know that. But the police are in essence in hiding, or they are concealing their identities post White Knight because they don't want to get gunned down in their houses anymore. And the 7th Cavalry is a very violent and well organized terrorist organization. That is definitely fleshed out more later and comes up. So you will see more explanation of
The
White Knight, and
we'll see. Okay. What else you got? You're right. Watch batteries is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Flying spaceship thing that the sheriff uses. You said it's, you know, it's evocative of the owl thing.
It's an homage to the original comic. I don't even know if it's in any more of it. I think that was just the one time.
Okay. Weird English dude in the castle. Mm-hmm. Specifically the assistants that seem strangely like NPCs. Like they don't know.
That's a good,
the difference between a knife and a horseshoe. I mean, this is like a wild character, like moment, you know, like he says, cut the cake, and he hands him a horseshoe. What the heck does that mean? This is what throws my critical thinking kind of out of the window. Like what, please explain what the heck you're doing here. And the pocket watch, there's some heavy significance to that. I mean, we get like some indication, but there, you know, it's a mystery. The guy in the wheelchair, he can lift 200 pounds, and then he shows up at this lynching of the sheriff. Right? This is a very mysterious thing. It doesn't feel straightforward to me. So that's my list.
Everything you just listed is what makes this show great, because at least in my mind, I don't want to set it up and then, you know, it falls flat for you. But all of the things that you just said are explained in a satisfactory way to me, and it all works, which is what makes it great. Like, there's no, you know, there's no, you know, magic that Dr. Manhattan shows up and reverses time and then the wheelchair guy can do things that he, no, it's all in universe explained in a way. It's all a mystery, and it's a fantastic mystery story. Mm. And I find the conclusion great.
Okay.
And so did most other people. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I am excited.
You are right to be skeptical. I was very skeptical the first time, 'cause like you said, there's a lot of weirdness and there's a lot of plot threads, and it takes a lot of time to wrap up a lot of those style of plot threads. So, but it does pay off.
If you remember, like, the beginning of Better Call Saul, I thought Better Call Saul was, like, super indulgent and just not not that good. I mean, it was a good show at the beginning. Like, you know, well-made, well-acted, well-written, but just slow out the gate, and, like, the premise wasn't really clear. Like, what are we trying to learn here? What's going on? I want to know what your objective is out the gate. I want to know what the premise is. And that's what, like, I thought Breaking Bad, you know, did better. So even though these things may be explained later, I guess if you're doing a TV show, to me, I would prefer to have some inertia coming out the gate, you know, like some real mysteries to latch on to, some, like, maybe one or two mysteries that are presented that we don't know anything about, but, like, there's, you know, like 10 here. So although they may be explained very awesomely later, I still don't love this style of show, you know, but
okay,
I guess we'll get there. I'm encouraged by your explanation that every one of these things that I listed have satisfying explanations. So I am encouraged by that. If I'm just a person that walks into the show and watches it by himself, I mean, I wouldn't be as encouraged, I guess. So
I think there is a case to be made for, if you weren't familiar with the original material and you just watched, you know, this first episode or maybe the first two, I could see that you would be put off, because it is a very non-standard style of storytelling. You know, I mean, I guess in some sense, you know, I mean, it's a murder mystery. It's sort of like Knives Out, you know, where it all ties together, but it also plays around in sort of this fantastical, surreal universe in an interesting way. So it's worth it. I'm curious, once we get about halfway through, if you're happy with some of the, because what's going to happen is half of the things you just mentioned are going to get wrapped up, and you're going to get twice as many new mysteries, and you may be overwhelmed because there's just so many weird things in this show, but ultimately they do all tie together. So we'll see.
Okay.
Again, I'm happy with it. I don't know if you're going to be happy with it, but it'll be a fun ride either way.
It's tough. It's a tough thing for me, but
okay,
I'm willing to go on this journey. So let's do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been a long first episode, so we'll cut it here, and we'll be back for episode 2.